Hello, I'm Tony Collins, and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. It's Christmas week, and in this week of traditions, I thought I'd break with tradition and do a podcast devoted not to rugby or the football codes, but to cricket. The reason for this is that today's guest, my old friend Duncan Stone, has published a very important book on the history of cricket called Different Class, The Untold Story of English Cricket. It's the story of the game written from the grassroots up, so it presents a very different picture of the game that we're used to reading about. But not only does it give a perspective on the sport that Rugby Reloaded has tried to do for rugby, but it also looks at the current problems that cricket is facing, which are reflected not just in other sports, but in society as a whole. So, welcome to the show, Duncan. Good to have you on.
Good morning, Tony. Again, nice to speak to you.
Yeah, great to have you on at last. So, to start off, what was your aim in writing Different Class?
To be perfectly honest, it was an itch I had to scratch. So going all the way back to my master's dissertation at Leicester University in 2002, that's how long this has been going on, I looked at the different cultures of cricket in Yorkshire and Surrey. So I did a survey of 400 supporters of the counties, and it transpired that the supporters in Yorkshire and the supporters in Surrey confer very different meanings on cricket. But the limitations of the master's dissertation, basically, and sociology, dare I say, meant that, you know, I just had to present that data as it stood. I couldn't really sort of contextualize it. And then a short 8 years later, I revisited that research and did my PhD in history in Yorkshire, Huddersfield, and that's when I put all the contextualised clothing onto the Surrey experience in particular. And from there on, 5 years after the PhD, then it was a case of, right, well, I need to see this through to the end, and that obviously meant writing a book about cricket in England as a whole, recreational cricket, that is. Because I knew, in terms of class dynamics, regional identity, and things like that, that there was a very important story that had been previously hidden. You would never get an inkling of the story I tell in Different Class in any of the orthodox histories, because, as you say, they're all sort of top-down, histories of great men, shall we say, rather than ordinary people.
I think that's the great thing about it, that for the first time you really get a sense of how the grassroots has developed over the past century and a half or so. And also, the other great thing about this is that, as you said, previous histories by and large have either done the great man of history type of top-down approach, or they've been focused on the northern counties and the difference between the north and the south. But you've done this fantastic thing and actually written and researched about grassroots cricket in the south of England that's not the kind of chocolate box village cricket mythology, but it's about how ordinary people played cricket in the south of England over the course of the last century. And you found out some very interesting things in doing that, didn't you? That it's not so different from the way that club cricket, league cricket operated in the north of England.
Oh, no, exactly. Prior to the First World War, with a few sort of pockets of, amateur approaches, you know, non-competitive cricket, the culture of cricket in England as a whole was effectively the same everywhere. It was only after the First World War that an organisation called the Club Cricket Conference decided to reject competition entirely. And they effectively banned cups and leagues in the southeast of England for 50 years. Now, obviously, the reason how they did it, the hiatus of the First World War was a big help. But why they did it was the fact that, I'm afraid to say, the elites of this country detest meritocracy, even in something as benign as recreational cricket, because they'd learnt the lesson. I mean, obviously, rugby split in two over these issues. But they'd learned the lesson from the professionalisation of football in 1885 that actually fair and open meritocratic competition, as exemplified by cup and league cricket, challenged their position within the game. You know, as the amateur teams, such as the Wanderers, found in football, very quickly they were wholly uncompetitive and took no meaningful part in football thereafter. And they were scared that the same would happen. But obviously in the south of England, where it was a bit more, or becoming more suburban, and it didn't have tens of thousands of industrial workers all concentrated in one place, they had a bit more leeway to actually bring this into being. I don't think anyone would have got away with it had they tried it in the Midlands or the North.
What was the nature of recreational cricket in the South then? Was it based on works teams, on local teams, based on streets or pubs? What was the how was it organised at the grassroots level?
I think it was essentially, again, you talk about the advent of civic pride and how important that was. I think even in villages the same thing applied. So after the initial thing of cohorts of gentlemen or games, intra community games, then villages sort of began to establish their own clubs, and obviously towns, such as my hometown of Guildford. And invariably, they would all play the same. Once the Cup and League formats were introduced, an explosion of competitions created by innumerable local and regional cricket associations, very similar to those established in football and rugby, created all of these competitions, and the number of clubs just expanded, exponentially. So invariably it would be the same as football. You would have Cup and League competitions, and it didn't matter necessarily on whether this was in an urban context or a rural context, or even a suburban context. That irrespective of the environment and the class of people who were playing, I would, I'm plucking a figure out of the air, but it seems from the research that the overwhelming majority of recreational cricket played before 1914, north or south, was effectively the same, and it was above all meaningful competitive matches rather than these standalone challenges for money that the aristocracy obviously made famous in the 18th century, or just in friendly matches between cohorts of middle-class clubs that dominated certainly the image of the cricket in the South after the First World War.
So how long did it take for leagues and cups to come back in the South of England if they'd been essentially expunged in the 1920s? But did they come back in the, 1960s, 1970s, or was it longer?
It's, in some respects, the class-based split that occurred between league and union occurred within villages in the south of England after 1918. So a village just up the road from me, Cranley, prior to 1914, Cranley Cricket Club, broadly speaking, represented the community as a whole. After 1918, it would appear the main club, which has obviously the best facilities, was essentially taken over by the local middle classes, who had expanded greatly because in 1865, both a private school and a railway station were built in the village. It's supposedly the largest village in England. I dispute that. But whereas this forced the formation of a separate working men's team, the working men's team did compete in the league. Whereas Cranley adopted the ethos of the club cricket conference, and they played non-competitive friendly cricket. And these cultural and social differences meant that never the twain shall meet, even though these are neighbours who obviously all enjoy playing cricket. But the culture that the different classes within Cranley played cricket to varied immensely. In some respects, league cricket never went away, but it wasn't played by the clubs that, in inverted commas, mattered the clubs that were had the best facilities and the most money and the highest status individuals. So it took until 1968 when Rahman Subbarao and Norman Parkes, Rahman obviously who had an England career, Norman Parkes was a very well-known and accomplished club cricketer who played as high as the Surrey second 11. They got together, having met each other at a Christmas dinner in 1966, and they basically challenged the Club Cricket Conference in saying, well, we need league cricket because young players are simply not coming through. Standards of play are declining because old men, basically, euphemistically known as non-benders, and I'm certainly in that bracket today, were hogging places in clubs that purported to represent the best standards of cricket. Patently, that wasn't the case. There was an awful lot of working class talent going to waste because they either weren't welcome at these elite clubs or they couldn't afford the subscriptions. And after a two-year battle, they managed to actually bypass the conference in some respects and establish the Surrey Clubs Championship, officially the first senior cricket league in the south of England in 1968. And from that point onwards, the floodgates opened and everybody was basically scrambling to establish leagues to make sure that they weren't left behind.
So what was the attitude of the, if you like, the working class clubs, in inverted commas, what was their attitude towards amateurism? Because obviously, in the north of England, league cricket clubs, local cricket clubs, you know, there wasn't really a divide between amateurs and professionals. Some players got paid, some players didn't, and that was what it was. Was there anything, was there an equivalent in the south, or was the amateur rules imposed rigidly on club cricket?
It's hard to tell. I mean, there's not a massive amount of minute books that have either survived various pavilion fires or have been deposited into the Surrey History Centre. So if anyone's listening, please do so. I think the attitude, whether they played in leagues or not, professionalism was pretty rare. I did come across examples of players being given, shall we say, honorariums for good seasons or having testimonials, or one chap after the Second World War was signed by a club in the Bolton League, and his club in Surrey had a whip round for him despite being in debt and gave him 21 guineas to, you know, send him on his way with their best wishes. So there were elements of professionalism, but broadly speaking, the amateur ideal of playing cricket for love was adhered to, I would say. But that really shouldn't prohibit you from playing competitive cricket, should it? And that's the point I really wanted to get across, is that competitive cricket was essentially outlawed in the South by a tiny minority of elite cricketers in their own self-interest.
And I think one of the things that's always struck me, and this comes from kind of family tradition, that when Surrey won the seven county championships on the trot in the 1950s, they were commonly seen as a kind of almost like a northern team in the south. And certainly that was the impression my grandfather was a massive cricket fan, who always thought that the Surrey team in the 50s was played more like a Yorkshire and Lancashire side. So, I mean, that obviously could have just been down to an accident of leadership or something like that. But does that tell us anything about the cricket cultures in Surrey in comparison to Yorkshire, Lancashire, Notts? Did the county club have something different in its attitude because of where it drew its players from?
I think it did. I mean, I think Surrey, in terms of the county clubs of the south, was always a bit of an anomaly. Certainly compared to the likes of Kent, Middlesex and Sussex. It was, in the late 19th, early 20th century, it was a professional outfit. And certainly Surridge was an extremely competitive, player who wanted to win. But I think as far as team selection goes, I think, yes, Surrey was, your granddad was absolutely right. I mean, he was there at the time. He would have seen it with his own eyes. But I have to look at things, in hindsight. But it does appear that Surrey was run, broadly speaking, in a more workmanlike manner, shall we say, a more businesslike manner than many of the other overtly amateur county clubs. So it's probably no wonder that they won seven in a row, although I don't know what was happening in Yorkshire and Lancashire at that time.
Probably usual internal political crises that paralyzed them for several years, as is usually the case. You mentioned there the way you did the research, and I think, again, that's one of the outstanding features of the book, that you've mined a lot of different sources to create this picture of cricket. Where did you find your sources, and what were the most useful ones?
This was the thing, and as I explained this, I've got a slight mini sort of autobiography in the book, and how I talk about how the book came about. But when I started the PhD, obviously in history, I mean, there was no archive. I had to find it for myself. So I did things as extreme as getting the telephone book out and, having Googled who is the person at the club cricket conference. And I looked him up in the phone book and I rang him up. And lo and behold, there were the club cricket conferences minute books untouched for probably about 30 years in his loft. I put an advert in the Surrey Advertiser. In the, a lot of the local newspapers have these, past times little articles, and they put a little article in there for me. And one of the first respondents was a chap called Ray Cotton, who ran one of the most popular and famous knockout cup competitions of the second half of the 20th century, the Flora Doris Cup. And we met for a chat interview. And again, he's turned up, handful of minute books nobody had ever looked at before. Then it was an awful lot of luck. I remember being at a BSSH, a British Sports History Conference, down at Eastbourne. Myself and another PhD student have gone into a local bookstore, and I've just picked up two books that turned out to be two of the greatest sort of contemporary accounts of recreational cricket in the South you could imagine. The Weekend Cricketer by ACL Bennett. So I've had an inordinate amount of luck. But in some respects, yes, you do make your own luck. But the diversity of sources is the fact that I've spent 13 years on this. It wasn't just the 5 years of the PhD. I've spent, doing jobs in between times. I spent a lot of time on this, and that has given me the breadth of sources that, obviously, if I'd written it, in a short period of time, I would have missed a lot of stuff. So I suppose, without wanting to sound big-headed, you get out what you put in. And I think the time I've devoted to the book has paid dividends in the sources that you mentioned, because a lot of those would have either never been discovered or would have passed me by had I not, devoted that time. But again, the Surrey History Centre does have some minute books, and they were incredibly helpful as well in terms of the immediate post-war period, World War II, that is. But yes, there's never enough, is there, Tony?
Yeah, so moving on from researching books to books that already exist, I wondered how you saw your book fit in with that other, if you like, critical tradition or outsider tradition to some extent, of books like Roland Bowen's, I think it was 1967, History of Cricket, which took a very different view of the game, probably for the first time in serious literature. Mike McHugh's Anyone But England, which is probably the best known of these books, but also one that's forgotten about now, Derek Bailey's A Willow Wand, which was a great debunking of many of the myths of cricket. So I wondered how you saw, whether you saw yourself as building on their work, or how you saw your book as fitting in with that kind of, unorthodox cricket history tradition.
Yeah, I'm in the awkward squad, Tony.
Awkward squad, that's it, yeah.
Yeah, they're obviously inspirations. You know, obviously your work on rugby, you know, Dave Russell's stuff on football, and as you say, Marcuse, probably in particular, as he was the most recent of those. But I think obviously Bowen, as you say, was the original. He was the founding father of the awkward squad, and then, you know, as I say in the book, if he upset the apple cart, Burley tipped it over in 1979. And then Marcuse probably then attempted to burn the whole orchard down with anyone but England. But that came out as long ago as 1994. And the reception of his book, you know, universally adored and respected by people from other cricketing nations, especially, you know, the West Indies, India, Pakistan, but damned with faint praise by the cricket establishment here at home. Now, Marcuse, in the fullness of time, has been proved absolutely correct. And as much as my book has received, to some extent, the same response, cricket doesn't have another 30 years to get its act together. So I find it utterly amazing and deeply humbling that people are now talking of my book, Different Class, in the same breath as, you know, Bowen, Marcuse, and even CLR James. So it's, you know, it's very flattering, but will it make a difference? You know, other than being something that is of interest to historians and students of the game and people who really want to see cricket truly, I mean, arguably, did it ever join the 20th century, let alone the 21st century? So I'm hopeful that the book will have an impact. And as we talk, Azeem Rafiq is giving his second round of evidence to the DCMS. But obviously there's a class issue at stake, and class is the basis of the book. You know, I think, as is being recognised by a lot of academic studies now in terms of social mobility in society at large, classism, or the nebulous elitism, is a real problem in cricket. Cricket is one of the most elitist institutions, arguably, in the country. And if it is so going to be fit for another 100 years or whatever, rather than inventing unwanted and unwarranted fourth formats of the game, it really needs to deal with the elitism that Roland Bowen highlighted 40 or more years ago.
Yeah, I think that, well, just briefly segue back to your book, I think one of the things that your book does, which the, you know, not Marcuse, Bowen and Burley didn't do, your book attacks the elitism, but also demonstrates how ordinary cricketers played a massive role in the history of the game. And I think that kind of, you know, bringing the, if you like, the rank and file back into the history of the game is one of the most important things that you've done in your book. And a few other people have done it. I know Rob Light did it and some of his work on Yorkshire cricket, but... So I think that's another great achievement of the book. Yeah, so to move on to the 21st century, and I think that's a good point whether cricket ever made it into the 20th century. As you said, today, which is the, we're recording on the 13th of December, Azeem Rafiq's giving evidence to the, in Parliament about racism in cricket. It's always been an issue in one way or another, hasn't it? Race in cricket. Not necessarily in the same way that Azeem Rafiq has been confronted with, but there's always been a sense that cricket is the game for the white elite of the British Empire, as it originally, well, as it became seen as. I don't think it was originally that, but it's certainly adopted and promoted in that way. And it's never really escaped from that, I don't think. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, unfortunately, the culture, the dominant image of culture, that, the quote-unquote quintessentially English game. Well, which part of the English community are we talking about? When you break it down, when you distill it down to its fundamentals, actually that culture, that image of cricket is only there to bolster, as you say, white elites who invariably attended a public school. So as much as people and other historians have argued that, the culture of cricket, this nebulous spirit of cricket, etc., amateurism and its ideals, was used to, shall we say, subjugate the subjects of empire abroad, it was also used as an ideological, cultural weapon against the working classes at home. And the banning of cup and league competition in the southeast of England is, could you ask for a more clearer example? In social control, they basically dictated to people that they couldn't play cricket on their own terms. So, I think getting back to the race and the class, and these are two sides of the same coin. The structures that were erected to originally either diminish or exclude working class participation were then turned against ethnic minorities once we had migration from the Commonwealth from the late 40s onwards. And the structures of cricket that exist, this fetishization of, the village green, or at the very least, having a grass wicket of a requisite standard, is a structural issue that is still used to exclude very talented, invariably South Asian clubs today. But it's not just a Yorkshire problem or an Essex problem. It's nationwide. Every county has this issue. So the culture of cricket is central to dealing with what Azim Rafiq is going through, and many other, less esteemed cricketers, amateur cricketers all over. But as I say in the book, it's a class issue as well. Deindustrialization, the loss of workplace welfare, has decimated cricket participation. And crucially, that was, while it existed up until, I would say, the late 1990s, that was the best example of multiracial sport, arguably, in the world. You look at things like London Transport and I played cricket for the police when I was working at Surrey. And obviously you would be fully aware of, the miners' welfare clubs that were up and down the country.
Yeah.
Workplace cricket was enormous. And, really, you could have devoted a whole book just to that. That is one thing, again, that, I suppose I touch on that has been maybe unfairly dismissed as, I think one historian described it as the bottom of the pyramid. It was certainly not that. And the research I did on, the standard of cricket in busman's cricket in the immediate post-war period and beyond was an incredibly high standard, because you had all these West Indians and Indians, Pakistanis coming over to work on the buses. And they were tremendous cricketers, but they were sadly excluded from the recreational mainstream. So their outlook and the way that they mixed with white cricketers was through workplace or midweek evening leagues where workplace teams competed. And it's a real tragedy that all of that has gone, because sadly it's not coming back.
No, and I think you make an important point that the same arguments and tropes about that we used to exclude working class cricketers from the top levels of the sport are exactly the same things that have been used now against Asian and other another minority cricketers about why they shouldn't be allowed equal footing with all other cricketers. These are all about, you know, it's a different culture and all these types of arguments. They're exactly the same that have always been used against working class people. Just to take up and just to draw things towards a conclusion. There was a survey in 2020 that found that the England cricket team had a higher level of privately educated players than there were privately educated members of the House of Lords. So in a lot of ways, things actually seem to be getting worse in cricket. That the kind of idea that people have that, you know, things are always getting better and we're moving towards equality. Well, that's not really the case. I think also that same survey said something like 45% of English professional cricketers were privately educated, which is, given the fact that it's only 7% of the population actually go to private school, is phenomenally high. So it means that the opportunities for, you know, players who went to state schools, we don't even have state schools anymore, but non-private schools, for them to rise, the top levels are becoming increasingly limited. And so we're in a position probably that cricket's never been in before. I mean, you know better than I do, that where it really is dominated at professional and international level by the privately educated.
Unfortunately, cricket, well, civil society more broadly, if I may be so bold, has suffered a bit of a perfect storm, you know, over the last 40 years. You know, with deindustrialization, with the adoption of a neoliberal, shall we say, way of doing things, it's profit before people. So, you know, a lot of the old firms that would have had, you know, a cricket pitch either next to the ground or, you know, a mile up the road, you know, once they were taken over by multinational corporations and whatever, they had these very valuable but unprofitable assets, which, of course, were immediately sold. And then, of course, we're all working longer hours as people in academia and all sorts, you know, just look at the variety of trades and industries that are going on strike right now. Everybody's being, you know, it's been that race to the bottom has been all too successful. But in terms of cricket, obviously, we've also had the sale of state school playing fields, you know, well over 10,000 after 1991. You know, it's no wonder that the privately educated are dominating cricket in particular, because this is by design. The counties, I get the impression, again, from the outside looking in, you know, again, with some exceptions, perhaps, they just want the easy wins. That because they operate within a closed shop, you know, although a two division county championship was introduced in 1999, it's still a closed shop. And no matter how badly run these clubs are or how bad a standard of cricket they play, they know they're going to get bailed out, broadly speaking. And this is why I advocate, again, if cricket learns from its history, I think the county championship should be arranged over three divisions with promotion and relegation, as was proposed, believe it or not, in 1889. But again, they learned from football and thought that a very bad idea. I think with a bit more jeopardy and a bit more, you know, meaning on county cricket matches, I think that clubs would be forced into looking beyond these easy wins of the public school conveyor belt and go into the inner city. If you're the bottom of Division 3, you're going to broaden your search for talent. And at the moment, there is no need for any of the county clubs to do that. They're quite happy treading water from what I can see. But if you're at the bottom of Division 3, you're going to go into the inner cities and find that talented South Asian lad, and you're going to give him that chance because your viability as a club will depend on it. Now, as much as there's racism in football, no football club would reject a black or South Asian player on the basis of their colour or their perceived culture if they were a talented player. In cricket, that does appear to happen because they'd just rather keep things, you know, as they are, the status quo. And again, I think if cricket was actually brave enough to introduce more jeopardy and more, dare we say, meritocratic competition, I could see the county championship actually expanding. Why not get the national counties involved? Why not get the ACE program involved as a team and the South Asian Cricket Academy, who are already, after only being in existence for 2 years, beating the likes of Surrey Second Eleven? I mean, if that doesn't highlight the talent that is going to waste in this country, as in many other walks of life, then I don't know what is. You know, 2 years and they're beating Surrey, one of the wealthiest and arguably best run counties, you know, in the whole county championship. So yeah, it's I forgot where we started, Tony. I think cricket needs to turn itself off and turn itself on again. And it needs a proper reset in terms of its culture, the type of people who run it, and in whose interest.
And on that optimistic note for the future, I'd like to say thanks very much, Duncan. It's been absolutely fascinating and a huge pleasure to have you on the show. And to remind listeners, don't forget, the book is called Different Class, The Untold Story of English Cricket, and it's by Duncan Stone. It's published by Repeater Books, and I'll put a link to the book on my webpage. And as I'm sure you know, my website is www.rugbyreloaded.com, where you can find a complete archive of episodes about the history of rugby and the other football codes, and now cricket, for your delectation. So until next time, thanks for listening.